The Sunstone Foundation presents Religion and the 21st Century, Toward a Paradigm Shift in Faith Consciousness. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We take you now to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Of this session, who has come from out of town to see us, Jim Fowler, who has authored numerous books, two of which are on sale at this conference, Stages of Faith and Becoming Adult and Becoming Christian, are sold at the Benchmark book table. Jim is a native of North Carolina, and he grew up there in a Methodist home, in the home of a Methodist minister. He completed academic work at Duke University and Drew Theological Seminary. He then finished a PhD at Harvard in the studies of religion and society, and completed a postdoctorate with Lawrence Kohlberg at the Center for Human Development, also at Harvard. He is an ordained minister in the Methodist Church and reports that his wife, Lurleen, is also a minister of education on the Emory University campus. He is also at Emory University and directs the Center for Research in Faith and Moral Development at that same place. He also has two daughters who are 24 and 21, an actress and a social worker. He is the author of 7 books, over 50 lectureships internationally, and this is his second Sunstone Conference. Informally, he says for fun that he likes to do horseback riding, play racquetball, and my favorite is that he likes to read novels that takes me places that I couldn't go or wouldn't go myself in a truthful way. Thank you, Mr. Jim Fowler.
It is an honor to be asked to return to speak to the Sunstone Conference. We had a lively session this morning in which two members of the Brigham Young faculty set an interesting context for me to make some responses based on two books that I'd done previously. And then I was invited with a delicious openness to talk about an issue of personal and hopefully corporate and cultural interest and concern in this afternoon presentation. I've chosen to speak on religion and the 21st century, images of promise and peril, and I will try to bend this in a direction of a dialogue with Mormon traditions as a preparation for our discussion after this formal presentation. We have about an hour for those of you who have the constitutions and the fortitude to stay for an additional hour. I'm having to get used to the fact that I've got bright lights in my eyes, and you're having to get used to the fact that the reflection off of the naked truth on my dome is pretty hard to take, but perhaps we both can adapt to this. It is notoriously difficult and a dangerous thing to try to gaze into a crystal ball and predict what may be the conditions that we can expect a little over a decade from now as we enter into a new century. Indeed, at the close of this fateful 20th century, we not only mark the turning of a new 100-year cycle, we also anticipate the turning point of a new millennium, the third of our common era. Nothing in my background or training or in my imagination has done very much to prepare me to be a crystal ball gazer. I must confess that in my 48th year, as I look at the predictions that I and others made in the 1970s, I am more impressed with continuities than with radical change in our times. Nonetheless, I would like to begin my address this afternoon by offering some suggestions about what may prove to be the case as we approach the 21st century. You will readily see that the vectors toward the 21st century that I'm pursuing are in fact extensions of trends that you too may well have recognized around us. You will also see that I focused more on geopolitical, economic, and cultural issues than upon technological innovation. I will organize my remarks toward examining a set of promises which the new century and the new millennium seem to hold. In each case, however, I will invite you to consider the darker side or the perils that accompany what seem to be positive possibilities. The first set of promises I want to examine can be identified as expanded choices. Our era has been characterized as an era of over-choice. From automobiles to vinegar, from TV channels to religious denominations and groups, from lifestyle configurations to leisure time travel and excursions, we have opportunities and choices to make that are unprecedented in human history so far as we know it. Because of continuing technological developments and the need for economic growth, it seems likely that our range of choices will continue to expand. Any of you who have bought a car recently, in addition to being shocked by how much you had to pay for it, were perhaps stymied for some time at least by all of the options you could have chosen. I'm told that there are at least 124 different kinds of compact automobiles alone that one can buy in the American market today. I anticipate that we will continue to experience enhanced opportunities for choice and for individual expression through our choices. This seems to be one of the promises of the next decade and of the 21st century. The peril that goes with expanding choice may be characterized as homeless minds and hearts. The phrase homeless mind I take from Peter Berger and his associates in a book that has that title. It points to minds and souls that are no longer attached or connected to particular places, communities, or traditions that provide standards and guidelines for the exercise of choice. Another author has characterized our time as leading to what he calls the vertigo of relativity, the dizziness of relativity. Too many options, too many choices, too many ways of seeing things. This leads us to develop what philosopher Carl Jaspers once called cipher skepticism. We're exposed to too many models of reality, too many perspectives on values and meanings. How shall we commit ourselves to one in the midst of the many that appeal to us? In his academic bestseller, The Closing of the American Mind, Alan Bloom of the University of Chicago asserts that the one thing we can be certain that undergraduates will have learned by the time they come to college in the United States as a result of their elementary and high school educations is the dogma that all values are relative. It is the task of a good liberal arts education, Bloom says, to try to shake up that dogma and to show that there is the possibility of grounding values and ethical principles on something more solid than subjective personal preference or solipsistic meanings. As we consider the peril side of expanded choices, we're reminded of the lines which come from the poem The Second Coming by W.B. Yeats. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Let's look at a second set of promises and perils. The second set of promises portended by the 21st century can be identified as increased global awareness. We are all mindful of the ways in which telecommunications media are revolutionizing our awareness of what is going on this increasingly small planet that we call Earth. And of course, if you've watched the newscast in the last several days, you realize that telecommunications have linked us to the outermost reaches of our own solar system in an extraordinary way. Slavic poet Czeslaw Milos, in his Norton Lectures at Harvard, reflects upon the impact of this globalization of consciousness upon poets. And let me quote, "The unification of the planet is not proceeding without high cost," says Milos. "Through the mass media, poets of all languages receive information on what is occurring across the surface of the whole earth, on tortures inflicted by man on man, on starvation, misery, humiliation. At a time when their knowledge of reality was limited to one village or district, poets had no such burden to bear. Is it surprising that they are always morally indignant, that they feel responsible, that no promise of the further triumphs of science and technology can veil these images of chaos and of human folly? And when poets try to visualize the near future, they find nothing there except the probability of economic crisis and war. End of quote. None of us, I suppose, will ever forget the remarkable experience of transcendence provided by that view of the moon, from the moon of our globe, which we came to call Earthrise. The radiant blue planet against the dark background of space gave us a perspective upon ourselves and our interdependence with all other beings on this terrestrial sphere that we could not have gotten in any other way. I believe we will continue to experience a widening of global awareness. And yet, there is a peril that goes with this expansion of awareness. The peril we face can be identified with that of fractured relationships and identity. Fractured relationships and identity. As we become really aware of those with whom we share this globe, we are aware in heightened ways of the strains in the human family. Speaking at the microcosmic level, we are painfully conscious in our society of the betrayal of covenants between marriage partners, between parents and children, and in business and in government, the betrayal and the neglect of covenants. We see the distraction of persons who are working to the hilt in their occupations, which leads to neglect and abuse of even privileged children. And then we see millions of children on this globe dying or crippled from malnutrition. Recently, I got a picture of the specter of hell on earth in meeting a young woman psychologist from Los Angeles who's been doing research on infant and early childhood life in a region of that city where most of the children are the offspring of teenage mothers. Many of these young mothers and the fathers are involved in substance abuse and drug addiction. As she studies their children, she documents the painful data that shows how their early signs, these children's early signs of brightness and responsiveness, by about age 4 or 5, begin to flicker and dim until soon the child's little light effectively seems to go out. And she says it is unlikely in most cases that it can ever be lit again. The fracturedness and brokenness of relationships and identity represent the dark side, the peril side, of increasing global awareness. A third set of promising factors for the 21st century have to do with continuing developments in medical technology and the mastery of human disease and frailty. Every evidence suggests that we will continue to advance the quality of virtuosity in medical practice to which we've become accustomed in the last 5 decades. A year ago, I bought the 15th edition of the Merck Medical Manual. As compared to the 10-year-old 14th edition, it has an additional 400 pages. It includes descriptions of operations, procedures, and syndromes, and approaches to treatment not even on the horizon of thought in 1976. We've become accustomed to the idea of the conquest of disease. We've become accustomed to the idea of increased longevity. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, a firm called Orgogenesis is literally developing living human skin from synthetic materials. Now they are perfecting the molds in which they will form living replacement organs out of these synthetic materials. Just as you periodically replace the alternator or the brake pads on your automobile, the prospect is that you can have your kidneys, lungs, or heart replaced by these laboratory-made replacement organs. It is an extraordinary future ahead we see in medical technology. And yet, here too, there is a dark side that promises to grow darker. I refer to the perils of new ills, escalating costs, and the maldistribution of services. We are chastened by the emergence and the expansion of AIDS, and by the realization that the new viruses stay ahead of our treatment options with surprising and elusively destructive skill. We read statements by honest physicians which express their immense frustrations at having to carry out expensive and taxing procedures that they normally would not prescribe in order to protect themselves against malpractice suits or to support the economics of the ever new and more expensive technologies in our hospitals. We are seeing the cost for medical care going up, up, up. And we know that nearly 30 million of all Americans have no insurance to cover medical needs or cost. This sad fact does not begin to take account of the billions of people worldwide who are effectively excluded from the quality of medical care which middle-class persons in our society take for granted. We see ourselves then on a terrible collision course. All of this extraordinary technology and capacity to heal, coupled with a narrowing and more exclusive ability to support it and to pay for it. We have not begun to resolve the issues of the just use of heroic measures and the inordinate costs of the prolongation of lives which show radically reduced quality. New ills, exponential increases in costs, and inequality in the distribution of medical care haunt our future and are the dark side of the promises of continuing advancement. My fourth set of promises in the new century center on the hope of nuclear disarmament. Since the breakthrough agreements reached between Presidents Reagan and Gorbachev in 1987, with evidence of the subsequent dismantling of missiles in Europe and in North America, we have reason for new hope that the two superpowers may have begun the arduous course toward a nuclear stand-down. We have reason to believe that Mr. Gorbachev is willing to acknowledge that the arms race is crippling our respective countries economically in the most serious of ways. He seems to have a vision of how impossible it is for the human family to sustain the levels of investment in defense and military expenditures which we presently pursue. We continue to spend more money in 8 hours of the arms race than we spend for a year to support the work of the World Health Organization. While we have high hopes for continuing superpower nuclear reductions, the dark side, the perils of the coming decades, still center on the dangers of nuclear proliferation. This becomes plain when we recognize two alarming facts. First, most of the weapons being dismantled thus far are virtually obsolete. They are being replaced in our respective arsenals by new and more frighteningly accurate and destructive weapons. And secondly, we stand in grave global danger due to the continuing proliferation of nuclear capacity among the more junior members of the nuclear nations. If my information is correct, now some 17 nations have the capability of manufacturing nuclear weapons. Then there are the unthinkable hazards represented by the potential use of lethal gas and weapons of biological warfare. A fifth set of promises of the 21st century I have called, simply and symbolically, More American Millionaires. The policies of the last administration seem to have created the conditions for an unprecedented upturn in the number of millionaires in our society. Never mind that this status is being attained in inflation-decreased dollars, and that in order really to count now, it seems one must be at least a billionaire. The stock market gave a strong warning in the fall of 1987 that our economy is finite and fragile, and that people and institutions can lose a lot of money on paper and in fact. I happen to have been at the Lilly Endowment office in Indianapolis the Monday the stock market took its decisive dive 2 years ago. They calculated that their $3.2 billion endowment dropped in value by $1 billion on that particular day. Despite our recognition of the finitude of that system, there are large numbers of people who have vastly prospered in this decade, and given the record-breaking day on Wall Street yesterday, we can expect that many will continue to prosper, while others among us will have higher taxes and lower standards of living in order to pay the interest on the exorbitant debts that our nation owes. Here we must face the perils lurking on the dark side of the still-continuing economic boom. I name these perils, debtors, armorers, street people, and economic colonization. There are two superlatives which we citizens of the United States are having to accommodate into our identities. I fervently wish we could deny them. We have come to be the world's greatest debtor nation, and simultaneously we continue to be the world's largest merchant of arms. At the same time, we may well have, among developed nations, the highest proportion of people in our population who are struggling to eke out survival and shelter as homeless citizens in our streets. A fourth dimension of this dark side of American prosperity bears careful watching. while arbitrageurs conspire to take over major companies, often depleting the capital of solid corporations and jeopardizing their profitable futures with immense debt, our nation is increasingly subject to the purchase of real estate, financial institutions, and corporations by Japanese, Canadian, West German, or British commercial interests. Japan now has the 10 largest banks in the world. The value of stocks traded on the Tokyo Stock Exchange exceeds the value of all of those in the European markets combined, and also exceeds the value of all those on the New York Stock Exchange. As United States firms move manufacturing and assembly line productions to third world nations in order to utilize cheaper labor, they leave severe areas of economic depression in the Kenosha, Wisconsins of this land. How can we expect that conglomerate foreign owners of North American businesses will be any more concerned about the economic viability of our towns, cities, or regions than our own average multinational corporations have been? If these trends continue into the 21st century, they constitute indeed a dark set of perils for this nation. A sixth cluster of promising possibilities for the next century I want to call to your attention. We may call the revival of religion and the pluralism of faiths. I think we may be in the midst of something very like the first and second great awakenings in this nation, and indeed around the globe. Before his death 10 years ago, Carlyle Marnie would frequently say that religion and religious institutions may have another chance to make an impact in the shaping of our culture, not because we deserve it, but because of the default of the alternatives. I believe that we are in the midst of a shift in cultural consciousness of titanic proportions. In face of the uncertainties and the threats of the emerging era, people are turning to religion, to mysticism, and to spirituality in at least two different directions. On the one hand, large groups are seeking to return to the established, authoritative grounding of traditional religious formulations and practices. Fundamentalists, biblicists, and those committed to the sacredness of institutional authority are seeking to find secure, if sometimes regressive, anchors in the midst of the winds of change and uncertainty. On the other hand, there seem to be growing numbers of folk who, having experienced the ambiguity and the spiritual fragmentation of life in modernity, are recognizing in themselves a deep hunger for images, convictions, and communities of shared meanings that will hold. It was Russian novelist Fyodor Dostoevsky who said that people require miracle, mystery, and authority. In our time of cultural ferment and uncertainty, it seems that people on quite different levels are being drawn again to miracle, mystery, and authority. And I would add to Dostoevsky's formula that people also long for community and for a cosmology, a coherent representation of ultimate reality that gives us place, hope, and a direction home. In our increase of armaments, vigilance, and violence, to try to eliminate the import and sale of drugs, we as a country are not recognizing the spiritual hunger, the emptiness, the anxiety, the hopeless boredom, and the lack of a sense of worth that fuels the market of precious human beings who become addicted to crack and to other forms of cocaine and other hard drugs. As we continue through a transitional time, culturally and politically, many observers say that we are watching right now the demise of communism as an ideology and as a form of government. We may expect that the revival of religion and spirituality will not be just a fad. In its myriad of forms, it may be a deepening and redeeming source of renewal in our society and in our world. Is there a dark side to this recovery of religion, or to this new turn to the religious in this country and in the world? I think there is. The dark side I would describe as rigidity, exclusivism, and false consciousness. In a 1981 book with the title The Public Church, University of Chicago historian Martin Marty wrote the following, and I quote, "Many observers envision that the 21st century, far from being merely secular, may be hyper-religious. They go on to say that potent human organization may no longer follow the lines of nations, but the outlines of religions, until great tribes, well-armed, will clash. End of quote. In addition to the Ayatollahs, the IRAs, and the radical Irish Protestants, the Arabs and the Israelis, I also have in mind the tendency of many of the emerging new religions, or renewed older ones, to lead persons to a kind of rigidity, a kind of exclusivism, and to provide reinforcement for new forms of false consciousness. These forms of religious false consciousness threaten to distract persons from the present conditions and responsibilities for the world, with promises of rewards in a heaven afterward, or they provide in their privatized systems of meanings a kind of blessing for the economic and political status quo, allowing those who are privileged to justify their sense, or our sense, of deserving our privilege in a world where others endure quite different conditions. Finally, in this listing of promises and perils in the 21st century, there is one set of perils which, in my view, assumes a larger and larger significance as we move toward the 21st century. This is the peril that focuses in the radically endangered biosphere on which the future of the human species, as well as countless other species of flora and fauna, depends. We can name this peril, with Catholic theologian Michael Fox, "Our Mother is Dying." Let me quote a few passages from the, I think, groundbreaking book by Matthew Fox called The Coming of the Cosmic Christ. "Is our Mother Earth dying? Consider Bhopal, Chernobyl, Love Canal, Times Beach, Missouri, the Rhine River, where 1,000 tons of chemicals, including 8 tons of pure mercury, were spilled. The river which Hildegard of Bingen and Meister Eckhart, the two greatest creation mystics of Western Europe, lived and preached their message of compassion and interconnectivity with creation. Consider these facts," Matthew Fox says. "Agricultural practices in North America today destroy topsoil at the rate of 6 billion tons per year. Topsoil is the matrix of all of our lives, the lives of the plants, the animals who live on the land and eat the plants, and the human beings who eat both the animals and the plants. It takes God and nature 10,000 years to produce 1 inch of topsoil, and the typical agricultural region contains only 6 inches of this precious gift. Each year," he says, "forest land half the size of California vanishes. There are approximately 10 million species of living things with whom we share this planet. The creatures range from fishes and porpoises to ash trees and rose bushes to coyotes and lions to dogs, cats, and humans. Currently, however, species are disappearing at the rate of 1 every 25 minutes. If current rates of destruction continue within the next 100 years, there will be no living species left on this planet. And how about water? Holy, holy water. To the best of our knowledge, water is a unique creation of our planet. How are we treating this holy and essential gift, this original blessing, without which there is no life? In the United States alone, we dump 80 billion pounds of toxic waste into Mother Earth's lifeblood, her water, annually. In the United States, one half of our water comes from underground aquifers or cavern-like reservoirs of fresh water. A study in Massachusetts recently found that one-third of its aquifers have been poisoned. The human race knows no way to clean up an aquifer once it is poisoned, and a poisoned aquifer will remain contaminated for at least 100,000 years. At Love Canal, where poisonous chemicals were dumped in the soil, there were 18 pregnancies. Of these, only 2 resulted in normal children. 3 resulted in stillborn fetuses, 4 were spontaneous abortions, 9 had birth defects, including incomplete skull closures, multiple rows of teeth, cleft palate, congenital heart defects, and genetic damage. All men living at Love Canal had the DNA in their sperm cells poisoned, and the human race knows no way of cleaning this up. And were Fox writing today, he would certainly add, "Our latest learnings regarding the destruction of the ozone shields at the two poles and the grave signs of the greenhouse effect raising temperatures and water levels on our globe. Is Mother Earth," Fox says, "not the ultimate Anawim, the most neglected of the suffering and voiceless ones today?" Now, your crystal ball, as you look into the 21st century, might well yield a different picture than is mine, a picture of promises and perils. Certainly, there are many other dimensions of promise and peril that we could mention and reflect upon as we look at the coming millennium. But right now, I'd like to take a different tack. Using a brief overview of stages of faith as set forth in developmental theory and research, I want to try to give more specificity and precision to my claim that we're experiencing a major paradigm shift in the levels of cultural consciousness in our time. Research emerged in the late 70s and the early 80s of the present century. It was preceded by the work on the development of moral reasoning by Lawrence Kohlberg and his associates. They, in turn, were dependent upon a tradition in philosophical psychology that began with Immanuel Kant and included centrally the cognitive developmental structuralism of Jean Piaget, the symbolic interactionism of George Herbert Mead, and the genetic epistemology of J. Mark Baldwin. In addition, faith development theory has depended upon the psychosocial theory of ego development offered by Erik Erikson. In its theological background, it has relied upon the work of H. Richard Niebuhr and the comparative religionist Wilfred Cantwell Smith. Faith development theory attempts to account for the operations of knowing, valuing, and committing that underlie a person's way of understanding and interpreting self-other relations in the context of an explicitly or implicitly coherent image of an ultimate environment. I think I ought to stop and try to say that in English. Faith development theory focuses upon the ways we know and make sense of our experience of ourselves in relation to others, and of ourselves and others in relation to the ultimate context of experience, what we normally refer to theologically as God. Faith is understood dynamically as involving both the finding of meaning and being found by meaning, both the construction of beliefs and values and the reception of beliefs and commitments. And it is meant to include both explicitly religious approaches to faith as well as those ways of finding and orienting oneself to coherence in an ultimate environment which are not religious. In our society, there are a variety of ways that persons try to go about the activity of faith without meaningful relationship to religious traditions. And while my interest, and I suppose yours, is ultimately in the conversion of human faith in the direction of religious faith, we have to take account of the fact that many people are making and finding meaning, well or badly, without recourse to religious traditions. In the empirical and interview research which we've used to build theory of faith development, we have identified seven formally describable stages in the ways persons compose and maintain their life-orienting systems of meaning and value. This is what you have before you on the one page, a very brief and short account of what we call stages in faith, ways of knowing and valuing that characterize people's making and finding of meaning at different ages and stages of their lives. If you'll look with me at that chart, I will review briefly this version of the stages. The first we call primal faith, characteristic of infancy, which is a pre-language disposition of trust forming in the mutuality, the give and take of one's relationships with parents and others, and the faith that emerges helps to offset the anxiety resulting from separations which occur during infant development. That's a very telegraphic way of saying something about an exceedingly important period in the seedbed of faith in our lives. At around two or beyond, we typically see the emergence of a stage we call intuitive projective faith. Here, imagination, stimulated by stories, gestures, and symbols, and not yet controlled by logical thinking, combines with perceptions and feelings to create long-lasting images that represent both the protective and the threatening powers that surround one's life. That, again, is a telegraphic way of pointing to the tremendous importance of our coming to awareness in early childhood and of our exposure to the patterns of piety, belief, and action and blessing of those who are our protectors and who are the primary ones with whom we develop our first love relationships. Tremendously important period in the evolving of faith. And then around the traditional age for starting to school, 6, 7, or 8, we see the emergence of a stage we call mythic literal faith. Here, the developing ability to think logically helps to order the world using categories of causality, of space and time. A child constructs a more linear and predictable understanding of the world. We develop a capacity to enter into the perspectives of others, and above all, to capture life's meanings in stories and narrative. Now, I should pause to point out that many adults continue to form and maintain their faith in the patterns of the mythic literal stage. So we're not talking about an inevitable movement from this stage to those that follow. One can become arrested or equilibrated at any of the stages from this point on. When transition occurs, typically 12 to 13 years of age, we can see the emergence of a next stage, which we call synthetic conventional faith. Here, new cognitive abilities, new abilities to think, make mutual perspective taking possible, in which I'm able to see you seeing me, and I begin to try to construct the image of me I think you see. Mutual perspective taking, and I begin to take account of the fact that you see me seeing you, and you see the you you think I see. Complex new patterns of interrelationships become possible there. I always like to remember that St. Augustine, in his Confessions, writing autobiographically, writes about his teenage years and says, "And I became a problem to myself." This burden of integrating the images of oneself that are mirrored back by one's intimate or face-to-face correspondence. Synthetic conventional faith. Here, one must try to integrate diverse images of the self into a coherent identity, and a personal and largely unreflective synthesis of beliefs and values evolves to support identity and to unite one in emotional solidarity with others. In young adulthood, we frequently see persons making a transition to a stage we call individuative reflective faith. Though I must say we've observed persons undergoing the transition to this stage at age 73 or beyond. This involves critical reflection upon one's beliefs and values, utilizing what we call a third-person perspective, constructing a perspective upon the self and one's membership in community that is not simply one's own perspective, but is outside or transcendent of one's own perspective. It involves understanding the self and others as part of a social system. It involves the internalization of authority and the assumption of responsibility for making explicit choices as regards ideology and lifestyle. These movements open the way for critically self-aware commitments in relationships and vocation. Please understand that one does not have to reject the values and beliefs that one has formed to this point in one's life, but instead of having those as a kind of fate or as a kind of blessing in which one has been socialized, one now makes critical choices to affirm or confirm those choices that others have made for him or her, so that membership becomes more a matter of choice and assent rather than just nurture and socialization. At or around midlife and beyond, there can be the emergence of a stage we call conjunctive faith. This involves the embrace of certain polarities or tensions that seem to emerge in one's life with oneself as an adult. Here, we begin to see an alertness to paradox and a responsiveness to the need for multiple interpretations of reality. Here, we try to hold together such insights as the fact that we are both old and young, that we have masculine and feminine dimensions, that we are both constructive and well-meaning persons, but inevitably or willfully can be destructive persons. In Romans 7, the Apostle Paul writes, "The good I would do, I do not do. The evil I would not do, I find myself doing. Who will deliver me from this body of death or this body of contradiction?" In some sense, the conjunctive stage involves coming to terms both with the conscious self and something of the unconscious self. In this stage, symbol and story, metaphor and myth, from one's own religious tradition or from others, are newly appreciated, and we see the emergence of what Paul Ricoeur has called a second or a willed naivete, a kind of willing commitment of the self capable of critical reflection to the initiative of our traditions and their symbols and their stories and the God who acts through them to shape and reshape our lives. The last stage we see in the interviews and research we do is one we call universalizing faith. Beyond the paradox and the polarities of the previous stage, persons in this stage are grounded in a oneness with the power of being or with God. Their visions and commitments seem to free them for a passionate yet detached spending of the self in love, which is devoted to overcoming division, oppression, and violence, and an effective anticipatory response to an inbreaking commonwealth of love and justice, or in more traditional Christian and biblical language, response to the inbreaking kingdom of God. With this last stage, a kind of process of decentration from self as the reference point that has been going on throughout these stages seems to have occurred, and there is a kind of re-centering of self beyond self in God that transforms a human being's way of loving and enables him or her to participate in God's ways of loving, a relatively rare stage in our experience. Now, I want to build on this perspective on stages of faith and return to the point I made early in my presentation that we may be involved in a pivotal time of shift in cultural consciousness, a time of as much significance as the Enlightenment of the 18th century, and I want to try to link that to stages of faith. I want to explore with you the thesis that there's a parallel between the shift from the synthetic conventional stage of faith to the individuative reflective stage at the personal level, a parallel between that and the shift in cultural paradigm which we associate with the Enlightenment of the 18th century. Let me try to explain this in just a little more depth. The Enlightenment represented a movement in cultural evolution where inherited symbols, beliefs, and traditions were subjected to the scrutiny and the evaluation of critical reasoning. Similarly, the development of the individuative reflective stage of faith involves the critical examination and exercise of choice regarding a person's or a community's previous faith perspectives. In many respects, this is a demythologizing stage. Creeds, symbols, stories, and myths, as well as rituals from religious traditions, are likely to be subjected to analysis and to a translation of their meanings into conceptual formulations. Paul Tillich once pointed out that a symbol that is recognized to be a symbol no longer has the power of a symbol. It becomes a broken symbol. The powerful participation of a symbol in that which it symbolizes, which makes it possible for the symbol to mediate relationship with the reality it represents, is now broken. While the conceptual analysis and translation of the symbol makes its meanings explicit, we may fail to notice that in the process of communicating meanings, the initiative has shifted from the symbol to the analyst of the symbol. And one way of the religious impoverishment of post-Enlightenment ways of knowing is that it puts us in charge of the meanings that traditions mediate rather than leaving the initiative to the traditions themselves. The Enlightenment, beginning with an intellectual elite in Europe and the United States, affirmed the sovereignty of untrammeled reason. It confirmed the individual rights and dignity of each person. It turned the eye of critical reason upon traditions and myths. It challenged the authority of monarchies and attacked institutions of ecclesial power. Enlightenment thinkers completed the severance of physics and cosmology from theology and initiated the scientific study of psychology and sociology. In religion, thinkers of the Enlightenment turned to tools of analytic reason and used them to study the record of biblical faith. Neither doctrinal traditions, priestly hierarchies, nor the Bible itself could withstand the relativizing impact of critical historical study. The Enlightenment produced a variety of social contract theories in order to provide legitimation for new governments. And in economic philosophy, it gave rise to what has been called possessive individualism, which more recently has been summed up in corrupted form by that well-known Wall Street philosopher Ivan Boesky, who said, "There's nothing wrong with greed." While there's much to be celebrated in the legacy of the Enlightenment, it is this paradigm which, in the main, has brought us to the point where we are poised on the lip of the 21st century, precariously between the kind of promises and perils that I sketched earlier in this address. If we are in the midst of a paradigm shift as regards the level of cultural consciousness, faith development theory suggests that we ought to look to the descriptions of and examples of the conjunctive stage in order to understand something of the probable shape of the new emerging religious consciousness. I invite you to consider a fuller description of the structures of consciousness that characterize the conjunctive stage of faith. The name for the conjunctive stage of faith implies a rejoining or a union of that which has previously been separated. I take the name from Nicholas of Cusa, who wrote about what he called the coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites in our apprehensions of truth. In the transition to conjunctive faith, a person begins to make peace with the tension arising from the fact that the truth must be approached from a number of different directions and angles of vision. Faith begins to come to terms with apparent paradoxes. God is both immanent and transcendent. God is both an omnipotent and a self-limiting God. God is the sovereign of history while being incarnate in the crucified one. The conjunctive stage marks a movement beyond the demythologizing strategy of the previous stage, where the latter followed the Enlightenment's tendency to reduce the symbolic and the metaphoric to conceptual translations. This new stage reverses the flow of initiative. Acknowledging the richness and the density of symbols and myth, persons of the conjunctive stage learn to submit to the initiative and the mediating power of symbols and tradition. Instead of reading and analyzing the symbols and metaphors, they learn to submit to the reading and the illumination of their situations, which these and other elements of the tradition can offer. In what Paul Ricoeur has called a second or willed naivete, as I mentioned a moment ago, the conjunctive stage manifests a readiness to enter into the rich dwellings of meanings which true symbols, liturgy, and parable offer. Faith relearns in this stage to be receptive, to balance initiative and control with waiting and seeking in order to be part of the larger movement of spirit or being. Now I ask the question, are we indeed in the midst of a shift in the paradigm of cultural consciousness? Are we in fact involved in a culture-wide transformation toward a new level of consciousness as we stand on the portals of the 21st century? If you remind yourself that in times of paradigm shift, we can expect to see strong currents and tides flowing in retrogressive directions as well as toward the new, I think the answer is a kind of yes. As evidence, I would cite the growing numbers of post-Enlightenment approaches to hermeneutics and in the philosophy of science and at the popular level. I would cite the growing numbers of post-Enlightenment approaches to hermeneutics and in the philosophy of science. I would also call to your attention at the popular level the immense interest generated in Bill Moyer's public television interview series with Joseph Campbell on the power of myth. Since the Second World War, and anticipated earlier by such thinkers as Einstein, the philosophers Wittgenstein, Heidegger, Whitehead, and Gadamer, we have been formulating the ground lines of philosophical approaches that help to grasp and to express the structural features of another revolution in process in Western consciousness, one that I believe will prove to be as significant a watershed as did the 18th century Enlightenment. Formulations of this new consciousness will have to incorporate the important contributions of the 19th century. What would these be? A full-orbed doctrine of evolution and development. I think we'd have to incorporate the critique of ideology and a full grasping of the role of overt as well as covert interests in shaping the scientific and philosophical thought and behavior of our society. I think we're going to have to come to terms with the will to power and the dynamics of resentment or of anger as forces in human behavior. We're going to have to learn from the 19th century to give attention to the social sources and functions of religion, of language, and of the fundamental categories of our thought. And we're going to have to learn from the Freudian tradition, which is essentially a 19th century tradition, to give attention to the tremendous cunning of defenses and of the repressed unconscious as affecting our knowing, our valuing, and interpreting, as well as acting. So we've got to incorporate the insights of the 19th century, but then there's some tremendous insights and gifts from the 20th century that will have to be incorporated in this new consciousness. We'll have to incorporate the awareness of the fundamental participation of all being in process. We'll have to incorporate an awareness of the relativity to each other and to what they observe of all perspectives upon the universe and experience, Einstein's great gift to us. We will have to incorporate an awareness of the intrusion into and involvement of any investigator within phenomena being scientifically studied, the gift of quantum mechanics. And we will have to incorporate the ecological interdependence of all being in systems, including systems of thought and consciousness. If rugged individualism was ever true of human beings, it was a long time ago. We are vastly interdependent, and our interdependence can best be grasped through our awareness of the systems we are and the systems which shape and sustain and give us our lives. We're going to have to come to terms with the maintenance of the cosmos through the counterpoising pull and force of tensional vectors in the universe, which give rise to a unity of such variegated inclusiveness as to challenge the human capacity to fathom, even with the combining of infinitely fast computers available to us for synchronous knowing. Now, what did that sentence mean? I really want to say by that sentence that we're in a period where, through the study of systems and through the study of the first moments of the creation of this universe, we may be moving toward a grand unified theory that would account for the lawful behavior of matter at every microcosmic and macrocosmic level. But to do that will tax the most competent computer capacities that we can envision, let alone those we've realized to this point. There are a series of thinkers in our world who are beginning to do this in such ways as to reconcile our new understandings of the lawfulness of creation and of the universe with more traditional approaches to spirituality and religion. And I think we're on the edge of a very exciting recovery of cosmology, which will help provide the linkage between these new elements of cultural consciousness and our traditional religious approaches. Now, back to where we are for a moment. Religion and the 21st century, with some reflections on the implications of what I've been saying for what I understand of Mormon traditions. I think this will take about another 10 minutes, and I very much appreciate your patience and your investment in what I know must be a little taxing. What about religion in the 21st century? What is God calling us to do and to be in the new era that is unfolding? If we are in the midst of a shift of paradigms in cultural consciousness, what stance are we called to take toward it? Are we being called to cling tenaciously to forms of ecclesial life and practice that we have evolved in the last two centuries, reworking, reasserting, and trying to revivify them? Are we called to a neoclassicism, or to a kind of return to a simpler, more sectarian view, like that which H. Richard Niebuhr called Christ against culture? Or are we being called to build on both classical and modern experiences of church, but to go beyond them in faithfulness to the presence and creative working of God in the burgeoning, struggling promises and perils of the new century? This question has some very specific and unique implications when raised in Salt Lake City. The Mormon movement, in my perception of it, and I must acknowledge my vastly limited understanding of the Mormon movement, in my perception of it, the Mormon movement offers an almost unique combination of pre-Enlightenment modalities with technological and organizational capacities that express post-Enlightenment realities. On the one hand, there is a system of belief and behavior which strongly counters the anomy and the fragmentation of meanings that give rise to what I earlier called the homeless mind. Centralized authority, coupled with the system of missions for young adults, forms an intensity of commitment rarely seen in Europe or North America since the enthusiasm of 18th century Methodists and the passions of New Light Protestants in the Second Great Awakening. In Catholicism, one would have to look to the missionary passions of the Jesuits in the 16th century and beyond. At the heart of the LDS movement, as I see it, is the formation of caring communities under lay leadership which surround persons with palpable meaning and caring, with hope, and which create and support moral coherence and purpose and restore a sense of vocation to procreation and parenting. On the other hand, the church centered in Salt Lake City has been a powerful leader in the building and use of telecommunication systems that build a common consciousness and practice at a global level. I had the privilege of having lunch with some of the persons in your research department and to learn something of the research that is being done on several different continents, studying persons who have converted to Mormondom, as well as some who have left, and studying some who might. It's an incredible research enterprise. I was much impressed by it. The questions of great importance, which I see in the light of this presentation, can perhaps be stated in two parts. Can the LDS movement continue to weld and to maintain a pre-Enlightenment spiritual and ecclesial pattern with post-Enlightenment technology and goals of global redemption and reordering? Or will the technology and the reach of this strategy inevitably draw the church into the experience at multiple levels of the acids of modernity? Will the church find it impossible both to tackle the complex issues of addressing cultural pluralism and to retain its clear, centralized, non-dialectical mythology and theology? Or will individuating tendencies arise within the church requiring new leeway for personal appropriation and reworking of that mythology and theology? A second kind of question that I see posed for the LDS movement is this: at what cost does the church maintain its combination of pre-Enlightenment and post-Enlightenment modalities? Let me address the cost at the level of social ethical impact on the larger societies of which Mormons are a part. Mormon social and economic ethics, as I understand them, have the tendency of being a transforming sectarian orientation. In the long run, the goal is to transform society through the example of a caring community of productivity leading to economic and political dominance. In a pluralistic community like the United States Society, this means a diminished emphasis upon dialogue and cooperation with other religious communities. It means setting out to influence others and the common good through aggressive faithfulness and evangelization, spiritual interpretation, and the acquisition of economic and political power. As such influence is gained, can the church avoid the pitfalls of movement idolatry and the aggrandizement through success? As members of the church are required to accept the ambiguities and the complexities of running large-scale, interdependent economic and political structures, what changes will they have to evolve in the combination of pre-Enlightenment and postmodern dimensions which seem today to make the LDS movement? And will their preparation and readiness be adequate to avert tragedy and destructiveness in our evolving global community? I have deep confidence that the creative, governing, liberating, and redemptive Spirit of God is enmeshed integrally in the processes of our growingly complex and richly dangerous project of interdependence on earth. In the statement of this confidence, it is hard even now to improve upon some words of the Apostle Paul. In Romans, he says, "In my estimation, all that we suffer in the present time is nothing in comparison with the glory which is destined to be disclosed for us, for the whole creation is waiting with eagerness for the children of God to be revealed. It was not for its own purposes that creation had frustration imposed upon it, but for the purposes of the one who imposed it, with the intention that the whole creation itself might be freed from its slavery to corruption and brought into the same glorious freedom as the children of God. We are well aware that the whole creation until this time has been groaning in labor pains, and not only that, we too who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we are groaning inside ourselves, waiting with eagerness for our bodies to be set free. In hope we already have salvation, in hope not visibly present, or we should not be hoping. But having this hope for what we cannot yet see, we are able to wait for it, persevering in confidence. In the light of the faith, we are being called to evolve toward patterns of life and nurture in our churches that enhance our abilities to form persons for vocations in partnership with God, to become and to help others to become more nearly the children of God. I am confident that the Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints, has a growingly important role in this movement into the 21st century. Thank you. Thank you very much. I suppose we should allow time for those who need to move and go somewhere else to do so.